Wake up, world. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, talking about food, drink, and travel as usual. And hello, Rabbit Oak.
Yeah, hello. You woke me up this morning with a with a whole new intro. It's like Good Morning Vietnam or something
yes.
like that.
Yes, hello,
but
world.
But we are, in fact, this particular morning, we are back in Italy.
Yes.
We're actually back in Italy for two reasons. We're back in Italy because one of our co-hosts was a little absent-minded and didn't notice that we had two absolutely fabulous tracks that we never used.
Well, let's just jump in and use those because they take up a full segment.
Well, but what I wanted to do is to let listeners know that one of the reasons we were reminded is that we are in the planning stages for a wonderful trip to Emilia-Romagna at the beginning of September. So if I needed a reminder, I got one. The city of Milan is very large, can be difficult to deal with, can be difficult to navigate. We succeeded in navigating it. I only half killed us twice on the way to the hotel that we stayed at, a wonderful place called the Carlton Baglioni, right in the middle of the shopping district. And in the Carlton Baglioni, a restaurant which is actually owned and run by someone who had it in another place before, moved it into the Carlton and runs it today with a powerful and a very professional hand. And we had the wonderful opportunity to talk to him after we had a lingering lunch.
I don't really understand why after this enormous dinner, I always get to do the interview, but it was a glorious meal at the Barretto Alberione, which is a restaurant in a hotel, but the restaurant itself has stood for a long time. And we're going to be interviewing Ermanno Toschera, who is the owner of this restaurant, a molto elegante persona. And grazie lei, Ermanno. Tell us how this started.
How we started this restaurant job, you mean? Many, many years ago. We started 48 years ago. We had a restaurant in Milano, via Sant'Andrea called Barretto. We've been there more or less 40 years. 40 years. We knew all the people in Milano because it was a very important restaurant, well-known restaurant. Many Italian people all over the world, they used to come to us to have food. They always enjoyed our place and our food. Until one day after 40 years, we have to move, and we moved in this place now, Hotel Baglioni, via Senato 7, Milano. We moved there 6 years ago, and I would say with great success. Unfortunately, with a lot of success. Now, we still run in this place, and people that come to us, they go away and they enjoy. Normally, they enjoy themselves. They like our place. They like our kind of service. They like our food. They like how we entertain people, and we make everything possible to see that these people that they come to us for food, they come back again. This is our politics.
Well, you know, I mean, we did not even know the history of this restaurant. We like the Hotel Baglioni, but we love everything. And could you just, you're in the north of Italy where everybody likes meat. You have the most splendid fish. Could you tell us why?
Now, because today people eat more in Italy anyway. They eat more fish than meat. We do fish and meat. We do normal cuisine, simple cuisine. We look after the quality of fish and meat. Now it is not fashion, but I think it is a must in Italy today that fish does better than meat. So that's why our menu is. In our menu, there is more fish than meat. That is the reason, anyway. And we try to make it at our best. And the quality, which is very important, anyway. The quality is very important.
Well, you know, we just actually let Ermanno free. food, select what we had. Do you remember what we had?
I do remember what you had, yes. We had, at the beginning, oysters.
Fabulous, and they're where? They're Marie Claire.
Then I give you some artichokes with prawns, steam, simply oil and lemon. Then I gave you some scampi with grated, gratinated in bread and orange flavor and parsley and virgin oil, olive oil, virgin olive oil. Then I gave you a little baby squid stew in tomato sauce and lentils. You call them lentils, I think? Yes.
Lentils.
Then I gave you a little bit of risotto, because Milano risotto, everybody knows that risotto in Milano.
I've had risotto every single day, but the flavoring is always different.
Now we make it with fresh peas. Now is the season of fresh peas, with little fresh tomatoes and seafood. And it is a very nice risotto. And then I gave you monkfish with cabbages, raisin, and peanuts.
Now, that was a surprise. It's more Eastern European. It sort of reminds me of what we ate in Friuli.
No, we use cabbages in Milano. We do a dish that is called cassola. There is a lot of cabbages and pork. And it is a traditional dish that we make in Milano. And then we do also some meatballs with cabbages. So there is a tradition of Milano of eating cabbages during the winter months, anyway.
Well, what I don't understand, by the way, is that you are all so slim as opposed to other parts of the world. Why are the Milanese so svelte and elegante?
So slim because I have no time to eat food myself. No, I'm joking. No, I think it's constitution, or maybe because I'm working 14 hours a day, always standing up and walking all day. Probably this is the reason. I don't eat a lot anyway, because what I eat is enough. What I eat is enough for me. I don't eat a lot of food.
This is a philosophy that's sent throughout the world. This is true. Actually, I have not seen as many fat people here as I have in other parts of the world.
I don't like to get fat anyway. Because suits costing too much money, you see? That's why.
Peter wants to ask.
I just want you to know that where we are is where you need be when you come to Milano. Because out the back door of the hotel, it's the most beautiful-looking shopping street. This is an absolutely elegant place to be. And what we have just discovered is it's also a wonderful place to eat. Now, you will be with us and suspicious about restaurants in hotels. What you need to understand is this is different. This is a restaurant enterprise that existed for a long time that chose to come to a hotel so they could move just around the corner.
And I want to ask, La Rabbit, why is it that we only go out to look at the shops when they're already closed?
Because they're not of money anyway.
No. There are so many great dishes in this area of La Verde. Could you just run us through some of the most typical, really the standout dishes that are typical of this region?
Yes, of course. About Milano, normally fish, we don't use having no fish at the time. The dishes, then there was risotto, because riso al salto, it is a little tart of fried risotto with saffron, because used to be made the day after. If you have the risotto today and you leave it because it's too much, it was utilized, you call it, it is right, they say, saying so, yes. And then we make veal, ossobuco, which is knuckle of veal stew, and we serve it again with risotto. We eat a lot of pork with cabbages, as I was saying before. We do veal breaded and fried. We do also some meatballs. We do meatballs again with cabbages and a lot of salami, and, you know, salami and culatello and this kind of food.
And lardo.
And minestrone. We eat a lot of minestrone, which is rice with vegetables.
And lardo.
Lardo, colonnato. So.
What is lardo?
It's very greasy and very spicy and very good. Lardo is the, in English, what do you call it? The under skin of the pigs, the pig, fat of the pig, the salty and then put in the open area to become older with flavor and with rosemary and with a lot of ingredients.
My husband loves that.
Let them dry for a few months, and they like Parma ham. Normally, it's salt. They conserve that this fat, you see, and it becomes old. 6 years, 9 years, and 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 18 months, and it becomes better and better. Yes.
What vegetables are very common here?
Cabbages, certainly, potatoes, certainly, zucchini, normally zucchini, tomatoes, yes, also spinach, and everything that comes from southern Italy, tomatoes and string beans, all this kind of thing. Also, we had a lot of vegetables. Pumpkins also.
And what about the wines? Because we have had such wonderful wines. In Lombardy.
There are some very, very good wines in Lombardy. The most important and the better of all, to my opinion, is Amarone. Amarone is a very good wine. Sforzato is the next Amarone, Sforzato. It is a good wine with the same grapes, but they let these grapes dry in the sunshine, so it becomes a little sweeter and stronger. That is a very good wine. And then from around this region, we do Barbera, which is a wine. We make also Cabernet from Franciacorta, which is Lombardy. There is some very good wine and sparkling wine in Franciacorta area, which is Lombardy anyway. Sort of champagne, some of them very, very nice. Other red wines, we use a wine that is sparkling, and it's called Bonarda.
Which is wonderful.
It is a good wine, Bonarda. With certain types of food, it's very good wine. And what else? Well, the others are from Piemonte anyway, other wines are from Piemonte. Anyway, Barbera, Bonarda, this Cabernet that I told you before, and Sforzato and Amarone are the most important wine that there is in Lombardy anyway.
And how about desserts? What are the major desserts?
Dessert, we make Zabaione, which is a cream, eggs and Zabaione. We make also, during Easter, we make this cake that, and during also Christmas, we make panettone. During the Easter time, we make colomba, which is more or less the same as panettone. We make this krafen. I don't know if you know this fried little krafen with cream inside.
I think I've eaten it. I don't know what it's called.
Yes, they call it krafen anyway. They call it krafen. You never had them before, no?
I don't know. I may have.
They fried fried pasty with cream inside.
Thank
God. Top, and they you must have them hot when you eat them.
Now Peter is poking me.
I'm not poking anybody. I'm just worried that all our listeners are going to be leaving the listening booth and they're going to go off to get something to eat because they're going to be hungry as a result of all the things that we talked about. So I thought we might ask Hermano to give us just a last thought on the Milanese dining experience.
He says the last thought. Now that leaves it open to you, and I don't know what you're going to do.
You have a worldwide audience waiting to hear the ultimate thought on Milanese dining from somebody who is doing Milanese dining 100% wonderful style.
Well, do I say that I hope that everybody comes to Milano, will come and see us, because we certainly will do our best to see that you that come to me will go away satisfied.
Let me say that this man has taken extraordinary care of us. We've had one of the most fabulous meals we've ever had, matched with wines, and it's been glorious. Thank you.
So we say grazie tante, hermano.
Grazie a lei, grazie a lei, grazie a voi.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Don't forget to email us at any time, onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, and we'd love to hear from you. You can speak English, you can do Italian, you can do German, you can write from, we've had emails from Greece.
Yeah, they're a little bit harder to read because we can't even figure out the alphabet. But we one of the things we did figure out when we were going to northern Italy, to the region of Lombardy, is that we wanted to know something about a wine that to me and I think for that matter had always been a little bit of a mystery, a wine called Amarone. So who better to tell us about Amarone than the family that's been making it for several hundred years, is still doing it today with a member of the same family who founded it in charge, Dottore Sandro Boscaini. And we had the opportunity to spend almost half a day with him, and we recorded his thoughts on what makes Amarone so special and what it is that Masi is doing to do it what we think and they think is probably better than anybody else. Listeners, you know that On the Menu is always trying to find a new and interesting story. So we're on the track of one today because we just discovered that the Romans were the first people to invent the process of drying grapes in order to make wine, because they found that that was a way that they could get wine to last from this harvest until the next one. Fast forward 16 or 17 centuries. Masi, under the direction today of our guest Sandro Boscaini, the president of Masi, has learned about how you dry grapes to do something different with wine, something a little more noble than that. Sandro, tell us a story.
Yeah, we go back to the Roman time, in fact, 2,000 years ago, where the wine was made here in this area, in the area of northern Italy, north and east of Italy, the hills around Verona and the Lake of Garda, using drying grapes for a simple reason, because lacking of technology, the only way to have the wine capable to survive from one harvest to the following harvest was that of achieve great concentration, or another possibility was adding honey or making over maturation on the vine.
What they were really doing was to increase the alcohol content, so the alcohol served as a preservative. Am I right?
Exactly.
Am I right there?
Yes. So achieving great concentration on the grapes in order to obtain more sugar in the grapes and consequently highest alcohol contents, together, of course, with also concentration of many other elements, including aromas.
But to make it simple, listeners, it was what caused sherry and port and Madeira and Marsala to be developed, because they had the same approach, except differently than making the wines called Amarone. They introduced alcohol from another place. In the case of Amarone, you increase the alcohol by?
By the grapes. Making concentration of the sugar into the grapes, and no alcohol addition is allowed in Amarone. Of course, another difference between the wines that you mentioned, the super wines that you mentioned, is the fact that here we dry the grapes under the roof. So we cut the grapes at the ripeness time, then we slice into the bamboo racks, and we leave the grapes to be dry from 3 to 4 months.
And this is not just a story about wine. This is a story about a family that bought into this winemaking business. Sandra, tell me how long ago.
1772 is the exact year when my family, the Boscaini family, bought the Masi land In fact, they call me Mr. Masi, but my name is Mr. Boscaini. Masi is the name of a property that in the high in the hills in the center of the classical Valpolicella area, one of the best places to make Amarone, this phenomenal red, big red wine made here with the dry grapes. And probably for that, my family always have been considered the guru of Amarone, always making wine through the drying grapes, like Recioto or Amarone. Recioto is a sweet version. Amarone is a totally dry, totally fermented version of wine made in the Valpolicella Classica through the drying process.
Now, listen, you would probably think that after 300 years or so of doing something the same way, you might just say, well, I've done everything. I'm just going to continue to do the same thing. But that's not the deal of Masi. You've continued to innovate. You've added to the wine portfolio. You've gone to Argentina. What is it that drives you to do those things, Sandro?
I think that we have a big patrimony in this area because we have indigenous grape varieties and winemaking method that together with the climatic and soil condition there make a trio of elements great to make fantastic wines. But this way to make to winemaking, means through the drying grapes, it also represents something old, but also new, or in any case, different. Making a different wine, a wine that are very enjoyable today, because represent exactly what the consumer today want. Wine with a bigness, with a deep color, with a lot of fruitiness. In this case, are overripe fruity, but in any case, great, great fruity wine. So, my point is that studying deeply what our ancestors did on winemaking, not because we need today to use that old technology to save the wine. Today we have plenty of possibility to save the wine. But because at the end we can have a wine totally different, totally and really enjoyable, I came to the conclusion that from Verona we can really teach to make a different style of wine, but a wine which is modern. I would say a modern wine from ancient roots.
It's a really fascinating thing. On our tour, we visited a little laboratory, if you like, a small-scale winemaking project where there are literally hundreds of different wines being produced and tested. But you're not keeping it secret. You said that you were in Italy just at the beginning of the month of April, quite willing to share the secrets of what you had learned. Why is it, do you think, that more of the world's winemakers have not caught on to what it is you're doing? Because anyone can do this.
Yes, but I don't think that we have to keep secret. Why to keep secret? We are doing our job, and we say in Italy, una rondine non fa primavera. A bird do not make a springtime. Need more than one bird. That's why I think that Masi, although is the largest producer of Amarone, cannot survive himself keeping all the secrets of this winemaking method. Rather, other producers, together with Masi, they are doing what, in fact, is happening today. Amarone become an international acclaim wine, and everybody can enjoy something different, something so refined, and a wine with a great, great story.
Now, it's a wine that is available interestingly and usefully valuable, will make the wine drinker happy, at several different points along the scale of price point. So you have a wine called Campofiore, which, if you like, is at a price that, an entry-level kind of price for a bottle of wine. And all the way at the other end of the wines we tasted is a...
Yes,
Take us through the range.
Yes, it's a different story in a sense that, of course, the winemaking method when is used correctly and with 100% of drying grapes, it make a wine like Amarone or Recioto. But Masi, due to this long period of studying the winemaking system, came to the conclusion that We can make many different wines using in certain way and in a different way the winemaking method of drying of the grapes. For example, Campo Fiorino, as you mentioned, is an incredible wine. It's a sort of super Valpolicella, where the super is given, the plus, is given by the fact that Valpolicella is double fermented with a certain percent of dry grapes, making much better in a color, better in color, more deep in color, more tannic, and a wine that share the best of the Valpolicella, means the cordiality, the drinkability, and the friendly wine with the food, with some of the best character of Amarone, like the spicy, the concentration, and the complexity.
Now there's a fascinating connection here for those of you of a somewhat historical or literary bent, because you made friends with the family from the region that we're in, the Valpolicella region, who had been here several hundred years before you got here, whose name is perhaps even better known than Marsi.
Yes, the family that belonged to the poet Dante Alighieri, the family Serego Alighieri. In fact, in the beginning of the 17th century, we made a joint venture, and now Marsi, in fact, is making and distributing wine from this that probably is the most historic estate existing in Europe, tracing back 1353, when the son of the poet Dante bought the estate, where the descendants still are making grapes and making wines.
That's an absolutely amazing story. But again, I've got to come back to the fact that this is a 21st century vineyard. This is a 21st century attitude about what's going on. What's around the corner?
Well, let me tell one thing. We are in the 20th century, but what makes the difference between the old Europe and the new and the beautiful wines of the new world is exactly the fact that in a glass of wine from Europe, you can have a tradition, a history. So you have a sort of romance that unfortunately lack on the wine from the New World because it lack of long story. Maybe they can make even better wine technologically speaking, but without the soul that we can have through our wines here, European wines. Next future, I think that there is a place for both. There is a place for, by sure, place for good wines, but we need also to be very attentive that the people do not drink the wine today because they need energy, they need a diet, but they want to pleasure, they want to enjoy wines, they want to enjoy a pleasure. So the elements himself of the wine as a beverage that is enjoyable, together with the story that we can tell around the wine, the place from where the wine came, and the imagination that a glass of wine brings to the consumer is the future.
Well, I think we've got two things going. I think we've got the imagination in the consumer. We've also got the imagination in the Boscaini family, which is continuing to reinvent the process of making a very traditional wine in an absolutely delightful region of Italy. Listeners, it's very accessible. It's about 130 or 140 kilometers from Venezia. It's a little bit further from Milano. It's very accessible from Verona, as long as you don't get lost trying to find the road to Trento that will bring you here. We think you should follow this trail and find out what the next descendants of the family are going to do. I believe you have two children who are in the business?
Yes, Masi is well preserved, I think, in the end of myself. And I hope for the next few years. But also the seventh generation of my family, my son and my daughter, are both working with me and keeping Masi alive for the future and always making wine so enjoyable and so different.
Well, this has been just a fabulous interview. We had a wonderful lunch. The difficulty is we have too many wine glasses and too many bottles of wine on the table, and I've been too busy talking to Sandro to be able to enjoy them as much as I could. So I'm going to ask Sandro to give us a closing thought, and then I'm going to go back to some Amarone.
The Amarone means, of course, we test a few Amarones today. We test also some wine that are made using the winemaking method like Amarone, as this Grandarella or Passo Doble that we made in Argentina, using same grape varieties and the winemaking method that we use with Amarone. I think that this is a great story, this of making wine going back to the ancient winemaking method of Amarone. But Amarone is also a great, great wine, very alcoholic, very rich, but also very friendly with the food. And I'm sure you enjoy today, for example, risotto all'Amarone, which is something typical of this area. But Amarone is also a wine that, believe or not, in my opinion, is the best wine for steak. So in your country, where steakhouse is well known, of course, nothing better than Amarone or similar wine like Campofiorin.
Now, what was the last wine that we tasted, the one that was more austere than the others?
Oh, yes. We tested a few Amarones. Among that, we tested the Amarone from the family Seregolieri. The last one is Amarone Single Vineyard Mazzano. Mazzano, which is considered to be one of the top single vineyards to make Amarone, very austere. For certain tester, is less Amarone, but probably is one of the best example of modern great red wine calling Amarone.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, what it does is it puts Amarone on the stage with the top wine, the top dry red wines from France, with the top dry red wines from California, with the top dry red wines from Australia and the rest of the world. It's been a fascinating experience to spend the time that we have with you, Sandro. We thank you so much for joining the program. The brand name, again, listeners, is Masi, M-A-S-I, available at various different price points throughout the United States. Thanks to the work of Remy USA, which was kind enough to arrange for us to visit here. It's been a delightful visit. Miss Anne's been sitting quietly next to me, but I'm sure she must have a thought before I hang up.
No, I mean, it's been a wonderful experience, not only from the wines themselves, the history, and also from the family, limited, immediate, and also extended family of employees, all of whom work for Masi.
And here's an interesting menu note. You can have risotto made with Amarone, which is quite delicious, and then you can eat it with a wine that's a passimento, which is dried grapes, but it comes from a different region. So this is a family that's continuing to reinvent themselves. They should be under your wine periscope all the time. Sandro, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. And I hope that your readers, they can enjoy the wines from this region, the Valpolicella, more in general the region of the Venetian region, and in particular the wine from Masi. And I can mention Campofiorin, for example, and Masianco, which is a white wine totally different, although it's made with Pinot Grigio.
There's going to be more new things coming. The neat part about it is you only have four letters to remember. It's a part of your wine vocabulary that should be there for all time. Sandro, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Wasn't that just absolutely fascinating?
It was one of the more interesting visits we've ever had to a winery.
And he was
delightful, absolutely delightful.
And a real expert, a real traditionalist, but at the same time a real modernist as well.
And boy, was that risotto sublime.
And now I think it's time to
take a pause
for the cause. And we'll talk to you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Hello again. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're going to leap from Milan to New York City for our next chat.
That's quite a leap, huh?
It is right over the Atlantic there. Yeah, we have a traditional steakhouse in Manhattan, and we have a Mexican in Manhattan, and we had dinner at both places and then talked to the respective owners.
Well, yeah, in one case it's a chef owner, and the other case it's the owner, and he has a chef at his side. That's, I think, first up, which is Benjamin Steakhouse.
Exactly.
And then we're going to follow up with a Mexican, right behind it, a Mexican restaurant in the theater district that serves...
Called Toloache.
Yeah, and serving traditional and reinterpreted and definitely non-Taco Bell kind of Mexican food.
Benjamin Provocage. Did I do that right?
Yes.
Ah, it's so romantic sounding. If I could get it to sound the way you do when you say it. You say it because you say it so romantically.
Benjamin Provocage.
Right. Oh, does that sound gorgeous?
Thank you.
Anyhow, you are the owner of Benjamin Steakhouse in Manhattan. How did you get from Montenegro to Manhattan you were at Peter Luger's for a while, that iconic steakhouse, and now into your own steakhouse?
I came as a student, with visa student, and my dream was always to work in restaurant business because my family owned a little butcher shop back home and a little small restaurant. So during the crisis, what was going on there, everything was closed. And when I came to New York, I went to school and I started working in the restaurant business.
And then you just sort of stayed?
Yes. That was my first priority, to stay in restaurant business.
Well, you've got some really good butcher shops in New York, haven't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
we had the people from Loeb's on the program.
Oh, they were good.
And we actually stopped by the store, but it's almost like they charge admission for everything. They're so expensive.
They are expensive. Why are steakhouses probably the fastest growing segment, or at least the steadiest growing segment, of the dining industry?
I think the reason is it because of the quality of food and the quality of service that they provide. People are lately looking for that kind of experience. Even if they spend a couple of extra bucks, they rather have a nice dining experience. And they know that 99% will be satisfied than going maybe to some other restaurant that it's a hit and take. Well, won't be like for sure they will have a great meal.
So it's almost like Motherhood Apple Pie and Steakhouse?
Talk to our listeners. Tell them about your digs. You're in a historic building. Yes,
our building has a lot of history. We are, this building was built in 1989 for chemistry. They used to do a lot of chemistry on the building. And the space when I owned the restaurant used to be a conference hall for them. They used to do meetings and presentation for their group. But 1990... Maurice Mohinion bought a building and turned the building into the hotel and made the space into a nice dining room.
Now, the hotel is called, I believe it's the Dillon Hotel?
Yeah, it's called Dillon Hotel.
Like in Dillon Thomas, not like in Matt Dillon.
Yes, it's D-Y-L-E-N.
That's what I meant. So there's still a wonderful staircase going upstairs and a balcony for staring up at, but not for staring down from, I think.
Yes, it's very unique design. This design was designed in the late 1990s, and we also have a huge fireplace, about a 10-foot fireplace, that usually we start on the cold weather around October.
Of course, we were there, it was 92 degrees, so we didn't have a fire.
not
hardly.
You don't need it that time.
No. Okay. So, but you do a huge lunch business, too.
Yes, we do, because we are located right by Grand Central, and we have a lot of commercial buildings around us, and we do excellent lunch business.
How would you say your place is the same or different than the place where you and Chef Art Toro both work together, which is Peter Luger's?
To be honest, what we did is we took Peter Luger's and we improved it.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, they are legendary. They've been around for 100 years, and we give them a lot of credit. But if you come in the city, you have to be different. For example, we did a lot of more appetizers, seafoods, and the main thing we did, we extend the wine list.
Okay,
so we have about almost 500 collection of wines so far.
Now, I remember somebody from your team had to help us to decide what we should have because the choices were so broad, including lots of wines we liked and even more that we'd never heard of.
Yeah, it's you know, it's a lot of new market. A lot of new wines are coming to market, especially Spanish wines are becoming one of the most famous wines, and we have also Australian wines and et cetera, et cetera. But The main wines that they sell in a steakhouse are Californians.
California big fat reds, right?
Yes.
Now, what's the secret to the meat? I mean, is there a
secret to the meat is first of all you have to buy prime meat, which is number one, makes it the Marlborough. It's in there. The second thing is you have to dry age it. We have our own dry aging box downstairs, which fits about up to 500 pieces of meat, and it has to be a special temperature that the steak can dry age to perfection.
Right, and you have the circulation. That's important too, I think, isn't it?
Yes. Usually it's 21 to 28 days, depends on the size of the strip or the short line, and depends how much fat it's surrounding.
So you make that decision on a piece-by-piece kind of basis?
Yes.
Now, where do you come down on the controversy of grain-fed, grain-finished versus grain-fed, corn-finished, or corn all the way through? Do you have a
grass.
Particular... Did I say grass?
Didn't say grass yet.
I meant to say grass. When I said grain, I meant to say grass.
Our meat, any prime meat is not grass-fed.
Okay, so by definition, you can't get the marbling level up unless it's at least grain finished.
It's grain or it's mostly corn fed beef. That's why, and there's this time, because it's so high demand for corn, the meat went up, especially our meat that it's corn fed.
Well, yeah, yeah. I don't know. I'm on a grass beef fed kick right now.
Yeah, but we did tuck in and rather enjoy the grain-fed side of things when we're a Benjamin. Now, here's a question for you, and I'm sure you must have faced this even when you were starting the enterprise. First of all, you were, in a way, you were going into competition with a legend called Peter Luger, and then you ask a whole lot of other people, and they would say, oh, when I think of a steakhouse, I think of Morton's, or I think of Ruth's Chris, or I think of Capital
Grill.
You distinguish yourself partly through your wine program. Are there other things you do deliberately to make sure that it's different?
I think we do. I think we are different than most steakhouses around us. And the reason is, first of all, we have very, very, very personable service, that we make sure every client who walks in our door, we know their name, we know what they like, and we make everybody feel like home.
Right, the guy who waited on us, I think he was, you probably couldn't identify him. I think he was bald or shaved his head, and that's about all I can remember, but he was certainly...
Yeah, his name is Javier.
Javier, and Javier did a wonderful job of taking care of us. Now, there's another side of Benjamin that is a little different. You're open 7 days a week, and breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Now, that's a little bit... Is that because you're with the...
in the hotel.
Okay. Yeah, but it's a little bit different. I mean, if you think of a steakhouse, you can also go for breakfast.
Yes, I mean, that's not... The difference is because we are located on the hotel. We own the lease of the hotel. We are open 7 days a week, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We have a lot of business clientele who come, either for breakfast, because we serve mostly like traditional American breakfast.
Now, I was reading some of the background information that you have posted outside the restaurant because I wanted to know exactly where it was. And there's a famous model who apparently says that Benjamin's is her favorite restaurant in New York. Can you tell us who that is?
Yes, Naomi Campbell, actually. It's our very often patrons of restaurant. She comes at least maybe once a month.
Hopefully unarmed.
So.
I mean, we never had. She's very, very kind when she comes to a restaurant. She's very polite. She just loves her meat, and she said that this is the best meat that you guys have in the city.
Guess what, listeners? If you eat frequently at Benjamin, even if it's only for breakfast, you can look like Naomi Campbell.
Right.
got you on that one. Miss Anne, you weren't expecting that one. Thank you. Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have a last thought for a listening audience? Remembering it's from around the world.
Excellent. Just one more time, we are located at 52 East 41st Street, New York, New York, between Park and Madison, and we are open 7 days a week. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And if you want to enjoy the best steak in the city, come to Benjamin's.
And there's a website?
Yes, and we have a website, which is excellent website. It's www.benjaminsteakhouse.com.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you very much, Adam Peter Hayes. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Benjamin. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, thanks.
Julian Medina, chef owner of a Mexican restaurant in Manhattan called Toloache, which, as I understand it, is the name of an aphrodisiac plant in Mexico.
Yes, and how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine. I'm happy to welcome you onto the program.
Thank you. Yeah, Toloache, you know, it's a flowering plant that is native from Mexico, and it's, you know, it's the purpose of the use in love potions. That's the theory, you know.
And you want people to fall in love with your restaurant.
Exactly.
Which apparently they do.
Yeah, that's why, you know, I pick that name because I think it's very authentic. It's authentic. It comes from Mexico. And also, you know, it has some history behind it. So that's what I like to...
Now, what's the history behind it?
Well, the history is since the Aztecs, they used to use it, you know. They used to do teas, and they used to make some powders. They used to give it to the woman, so the woman and the woman to the man, just for them to fall in love between each other. So that's why, you know, we had, you know, that's the history of the Toloache.
And you, do you have this secret seasoning available on your menu?
No, I don't. I don't.
Now, perhaps you should.
Talk about the space, by the way. It's a very interesting space. What was there before?
Well, the space, it used to be an Italian restaurant that we picked up. And, you know, the space is it's a two-level story with a brick oven in the middle that you know, they use it to make, like, pizzas and stuff in the Italian restaurant. And what I did is just create this guacamole and ceviche bar. And I used that brick oven, you know, as a center of the place, as a center of the restaurant, making, you know, quesadillas, casseroles, queso fundidos, and, you know, some other specials as well.
You know, we had a ceviche sampling, which was excellent.
We had a guacamole sampling.
Right.
We had a guacamole sampling,
two.
Right. So at the bar, we make fresh guacamole and fresh ceviche, you know.
What was that guacamole that I really loved? But what was that one?
I think it was a sweet one or a spicy one, which you...
Yeah. I have actually three different guacamoles in the menu. I have the traditional one.
Yes, we had that.
And I have the rojo, which is a, you know, with red onions, cilantro, tomatoes, and chipotle.
That was excellent,
with queso fresco on the top. And I also have variation because, as you know, avocado is a fruit. So, you know, it goes very well with fruit as well. So I have, you know, I put in one of the guacamoles, apple, mango.
That was the one I didn't think I was going to like it, and
watermelon.
I loved it.
Yeah, a little habanero
refreshing,
just to spice it up.
That was excellent, yeah.
No, you might have missed Anne saying that she thought she would hate that one, and turned out she liked it best of all three.
I know.
So that was pretty. Now let's make this very clear, listeners. This is not Taco Bell. This is not Chi-Chi's. This is not Garcia's. This is a real Mexican restaurant. Just happens to be set in New York City, and there aren't many of this kind, I think, Julian. Correct?
Yeah. I mean, you know, what I try to do with my cuisine is just be as authentic as possible, but also for New York standards, which is, you know, more innovating, more seasonal ingredients, organic ingredients, and that's what I do here. You know, I take, you know, all the traditional and the authentic ingredients from Mexico, and I have several dishes that they're, you know, really authentic, that I follow the recipe from, you know, from my grandfather, that, you know, I used to cook with him, and my father as well, and I put them, you know, together on my menu, plus some additions, you know, to make spin-offs of Mexican, you know, using ingredients that they're in season here.
Now, what, was your family in the restaurant business in Mexico?
No, they cook, you know, just for pleasure, and they never cook, you know, for any business or anything. But I, you know, I grew up, you know, in the kitchen at home, and that's when I took, you know, most of my knowledge and most of my love for, you know, for for cooking.
But you cooked in Mexico City and as
yeah, I did. I actually did cook at La Hacienda de los Morales, which is a really really fun restaurant. It's an hacienda which is right in the center in Mexico City.
And we ate there the first time Ann and Peter were in Mexico together. In fact, it was the one night I broke the rule about not eating fresh greens, because I figured if they would be good anywhere in Mexico City, that would be it. So we had a wonderful salad at the Hacienda, and
right.
We lived to tell the tale. So it must indeed be an excellent restaurant, and we certainly thought it was.
Right. Yeah, it's just a beautiful restaurant. That was my first experience working, you know, in a kitchen in a restaurant. I mean, that restaurant is just big and is very busy. It's just the kitchen is huge. So they do tons of catering as well, and you know the restaurant is very popular. And that was my very first experience. So I enjoy it very much.
Now, how did you come to New York?
I talked to a chef that he owns Mexican restaurants as well. His name is Richard Sandoval from Maya and Pampano here in New York City.
Oh, right.
And I wanted to come and move out from Mexico, and at the same time, you know, I was looking and talked to him, and he, you know, he offered me a job, so that's what I took, and then I came over with him, and then it's when he started opening. He had at that time a French Asian restaurant that I worked there, and then he wanted me to come and, you know, work to open a Mexican restaurant with him, so I did went and opened Maya with him, and that's how, you know, everything came out.
But this is
13 years ago.
But this is quite a step for you to have your own place. How long has it been there?
Yeah.
How long has it been there?
That's been 13 years ago.
No, Toloache
just opened last year.
Oh, boy, and it's going well?
Yeah, it's going well so far.
Well, you're nicely situated. Why don't you give our listeners an idea of
location? Yeah, the address is 251 West 50th Street. That's between 8th and 8th Avenue and Broadway.
So it's a good place to go before theater?
Yeah, perfect place to go before the theater and for lunch as well. We open 7 days. For lunch, Saturday and Sunday brunch from 11:30 to 3, and we open, you know, back from dinner for 5 to 11:30.
Well, the people at the table next to us were, I think, advertising people who lived in New York City, and they said they thought their meal was terrific, and on the menu certainly agreed. And who was the wonderful young man who took care of us? I've forgotten his name. He was your general manager.
It's Victor.
Victor. Victor made it a wonderful experience for us.
So, listeners, is there a website here?
Excuse me?
Is there a website?
Yes, the website is toloachenyc.com.
Better spell that.
Yeah, it's T-S and Tom, O-L-O-A-C-H-E.
Right.
NYC.com.
Great.
And they do killer margaritas.
Yes.
I had two, and I almost didn't make it through.
Yeah,
dinner.
I mean, I don't know how you had two of them.
That's great.
No, that was Victor. He said I had to have the second one because I had to try the house special.
Yes, of course. I'm glad that you guys had a great time dining here at Toloache.
And we missed you then, but we haven't missed you now, so we're delighted to have you as part of our program, and Toloache is certainly a spot for something different and in just the kind of place you need to be when you're hungry.
That's correct. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, thank you so much, and keep in touch with us.
Okay, of course I will.
Okay.
All right.
Ciao.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, I guess I shouldn't have said ciao. I should have said adios.
Oh, something like that.
Or something like that.
Adios, amigos.
But we covered a lot of territory here.
We did. We have recommendations to eat and drink in northern Italy, recommendations for where to eat and drink in Manhattan. And what did we squeeze in between?
We had the wine.
Oh, that's it. That was a whole program. Boy, time flies when you're having fun.
Exactly. And it is time to wrap, I believe.
We hope you'll continue to have fun with your travel and food and wine adventures, and you'll come back and join us again at On the Menu Radio next week. Same time, same place.
Bye-bye.